some good ones.
There's some real good ones.
Kev's is really good.
Kev's is really good.
You got let this play for a minute.
You've got back pain from the nerve impingement again. They got the claws in you, my friend. Into your claim, I'll fight again. Depose the witness from the scene. Your med bills are on a lien. Fight for you, also fight for you. I'll win a car crash into you, and I'll make them.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Justice Team Podcast. That was one of my favorite intro songs. That's Greg Schaefer with Crash Into You. Love sounds Greg. A lot like Dave Matthews, actually.
It does sound a lot
Timmy,
like Dave
Matthews.
Timmy,
did he do any sort of auto-tune on that one?
No, the whole time I told him to channel his best Dave Matthews, and he said, okay, I got it.
And wow.
Turned around, and then came back up to the mic.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Like all right, so today we're talking about MTBIs, mild traumatic brain injuries. Before we do, Murat John Abehan, can you tell us what you got for us today?
So for today's special episode, I decided to prepare what's known as Sunset at the Beach. We've got a little bit of vodka, some club soda, cranberry, and pineapple juice. And if you notice the way it was layered, it kind of looks like that pink sky during that, you know?
Mine looks like a Crystal Light.
Well, you've got a different sky. Some of these have the special sky. You just look up there, you go, wow, how pretty. We've got sunset at the beach
I thought
today.
Maybe these were the different layers of the brain.
Oh, there we go.
That's a great transition.
Great job, Ryan. Okay, so to my left, Ryan Conger. Say hello, Ryan Conger.
Hello.
Part of the Justice Team, also down in San Diego with his own shop, Conger Law. Is that what it's called?
That's what it's called.
You came up with that one, huh?
Took me a while.
I'd have gone King Conger Law.
Ooh. Ooh.
It's not too late to change.
Sevi Willard Fisher.
Hello.
Say hello.
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 Again.
Grayson Goody, part of the Justice Team. Say hello.
Hello. Good morning.
And
hello,
to my everybody. Right, we have our special guest, Miss BB Fell. Say hello, BB.
Hello.
I wanted to call her firm Slip and Fell.
Yeah, that's a good one. Can you give us a little plug?
Yeah, so I have my own personal injury firm in San Diego, and I do catastrophic personal injury, brain injury cases, and wrongful death cases.
That was pretty modest. Ryan, can you give the intro?
No.
The famed trial lawyer, BBN Fell.
Do it.
That was it.
I did it.
That was the intro. All right. So we're talking about MTBIs. It's a very, you know, I found out very early in my career, it's a very nuanced injury. It's a very hard claim, a very hard injury to practice with. So, you know, if anyone can answer, tell me what the difference is we're dealing with MTBIs. What's the difference between an MTBI, BB, and, say, a moderate traumatic brain injury, severe traumatic brain injury? What are we dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, it's all a difference in degree. But when people think brain injury, they think, you know, what we might see on TV is a major brain injury where somebody is having difficulty walking, talking, and you can automatically tell that there's something wrong with them. And when you go down on that scale, when you go all the way down to a mild traumatic brain injury, even though they're called mild, they're really not mild at all.
When you're dealing with the brain, there's really no such thing as a mild injury.
But what's so tough about the mild traumatic brain injury case is that if you don't know the person well, you often can't tell unless you spend significant time with them that they've got these major debilitating issues.
Yeah. So, you know, Ryan, what's the big hurdles with these cases? I mean, it's not, right, it's not a broken bone. You can't see it.
It's the invisible injury.
Right.
Right. And like BB said, I think that's a great point. A lot of times we don't even know the client before. The jury certainly didn't know the client before. And what you're trying to show is this subtle change, oftentimes subtle change from before and after. It's not subtle to the client, but it may be subtle in a, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes with the client on the stand. So you're really relying on your experts to explain how this type of injury can affect someone and before and after witnesses to talk about how they were before and how they are after.
So you know, Sevi, Grayson, when you guys are looking at cases that are coming in through the door and you're screening cases, a lot of times you're not, you don't even know that there's a potential TBI claim element, right? So how, what are you guys kind of looking at when you're looking at a case? Case comes in the door, say it's a spine surgery case, or you get it early on and it's, you know, whatever, what kind of injury, but what are you looking for? What can you see in the records that kind of indicate to you that, hey, there might be a head injury or TBI component that we might have missed?
Yeah, I mean, really just any kind of head trauma. You're looking to see if somebody lost consciousness. Even if they didn't lose consciousness, you can sustain a mild traumatic brain injury. If they have a laceration on their head, if they said that they're confused afterwards, maybe their Glasgow coma score is a 14 out of 15 instead of a 15 out of 15. Really, you're just looking at all that stuff, and then obviously talking with the plaintiff or the potential client to see what their complaints are. And I always like to ask them everything. Like, hey, I know there's a spine injury case. Very clearly, you've had a spine surgery. But tell me everything. Tell me how you've been feeling really top to bottom from when this happened all the way through today. So then you can kind of, you know, hash out what their real complaints are.
And sometimes they may not even know. So I think it's great when, if you do meet to, you know, sort of have that first initial interview with a potential client, it's great if their family comes in, because then you can talk to them. Maybe, you know, maybe the potential client leaves and goes to the restroom and say, okay, now tell me, you know, what are your thoughts? You know, and they may say something like, oh, well, you know, since the incident, he's been more, you know, combative, not sleeping well, having nightmares, things like that, that can sort of tip you off. I think, obviously, the initial medical records, you look at the discharge. I think the discharge paperwork is huge, because oftentimes they'll tell you, like, if, you know, this is what you do, you know, you had a blow to the head or maybe a concussion, you know, follow up if X, Y, and Z with your primary doctor. So those are good things to sort of look at and be aware of.
Yes. BB, how many MTBI cases do you think you've handled in your career? Not just trial, but like that you've worked on?
Probably since I started recognizing them, you know, probably 15.
Okay. And how many of those does the patient go to the ER and have a CT scan and it actually picks something up?
Zero.
Yeah, it's very rare, and it does happen. I mean, I think maybe in all of the cases I've handled, I've had one, right? So how can you prove a brain injury case? How can you prove that somebody, obviously, I mean, there's not much of a dispute. Maybe they hit their head, but how can you prove, that's the million-dollar question, how can you prove a head injury case, a brain injury case, with no, there's nothing on the scan? Like an MRI with a back, you can even see herniations. You might be able to talk about what caused those herniations, but with a, you get a CT scan at the ER, there's no brain bleed, they're fine. You know, how do you, what's your philosophy? How do you go about laying a roadmap to prove a brain injury case, mild traumatic brain injury case?
I rely very heavily on our experts, because the symptoms that you're going to see from person to person are very different. People are very different. Our brains work in very different ways. So I try to get an expert involved right away, and they're going to guide me and tell me, hey, you really need to go get better imaging than a CT scan in the ER.
So what type of expert are you talking about? Neurologist?
Neurologist.
Okay. So let's, now that we've kind of talked, BB's touched on experts, what are the types of experts that we're usually dealing with in a TBI case? We have neurologists. What other type of experts are we usually talking about?
Neuropsychologists.
Neurosurgeons, neurologists, neuropsychologists.
Neuroradiologists. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the real...
audiologists.
And I think the real...
That's kind of, yep. That's next level. Yeah, that's something that probably gets overlooked.
Well, and even with your experts, they may have a tough time, you know, if there's nothing on the imaging and your expert who evaluates your client or patient once, twice, maybe half a dozen times in throughout litigation, they may even have a tough time, you know, realizing, you know, where's this gentleman or this lady's, you know, baseline. So I think your real experts in a TBI case are their family members, the people who can, you know, show the before and after. Otherwise, you really don't have much.
Yeah, so, I mean, how... It's difficult to say, to answer this, because a lot of times it's going to be the other side that's going to dictate how many experts and how many types of experts you're going to use. But our philosophy is at the firm here is we try to keep it as small amount of experts as possible. If we can get away with just a neurologist, we will. But I'm interested, BB, to see what your philosophy is. You know, what are the types of experts that you're going out and affirmatively I need this person. Is it just a neurologist? Or are you getting...
Well, I'm going to start with a neurologist. Right. I'm probably going to get a neuroradiologist involved and get some advanced imaging to see if we can see something in the imaging that correlates with the symptoms and the reports. And beyond that, I'm going to focus in on what's really severely impacting my client's life. I mean, if it's a hearing issue, I'm going to get an audiologist involved. If it's a personality issue or depression, anxiety, I'm going to get a psychologist, psychiatrist involved. If it's real cognitive processing issues, I'm going to get a neuropsychologist involved. So it just depends. It's really focusing in on your client and how can you help them.
Is it fair to say, Ryan, that with an MTBI case as opposed to any other type of injury claim that you handle, you're probably going to be dealing with interacting with the client more than any other type of injury claim that you have?
Absolutely, because so much of it is about their subjective complaints and what they're going through and the timing of where they are in their recovery too. We know that they can continue to improve up to about 2 years. So I think you want to monitor it every step of the way and see how the recovery is going. We also forgot PET scan.
Mm-hmm. When she brought up imaging, I wanted to ask you about PET scans, but there, you know, I don't want to get too into the weeds because you can go on for hours about MRIs and fMRIs and advanced imaging techniques, but everyone should know what an MRI is, right? You have the 1T MRI up to the 3T. If you're doing a brain scan, you should be doing at least a 3T MRI, right? That's usually the highest magnet, the 3 Tesla. And then they have advanced imaging techniques. BB, can you
give just broadly? Just
maybe broadly. I can talk about the PET a little bit.
I mean, just, yeah.
So we were, BB and I have a case that's going right now, and I won't talk about the expert specifically or the client, but I think we got a very good explanation of something that commonly happens with the PET. So our neurologist says the PET scan in a vacuum does not diagnose a TBI or the lack thereof, and there may be some abnormal finding on a PET scan that could be there for 10 different possible reasons, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit. It could be there for 10 different reasons, but if it matches up, if that abnormal finding matches up with a lot of your other data points, like the neuropsych testing, you know, like the subjective complaints, like the audiology results, then it becomes a useful data point. It might, like you said, it may not be there for that exact reason every single time, but in this case, it all matches.
Yeah, and to BB's point, I think it's very important early on is to find a neurologist that you trust is not only a good expert, but a good treater who genuinely cares about the science of the brain and treating patients with brain injuries, because they can help you dictate what the best next steps are. Do they need to go into a program where they're rehabilitating? Do they need a 3T MRI? Do they need an fMRI? Do they need, you know, some sort of other type of imaging? So you really need to rely on your experts as consultants early on to kind of guide you.
When you're working a case up, when you're working a TBI case up for trial, I think, you guys tell me if you disagree, I think you start with the neurologist and let the neurologist run point. Just like when you're working a spine injury case up for trial, I think you start with your orthopedic spine surgeon or neurosurgeon, as opposed to starting with a chiropractor. When you're working it up for a trial, you know, and I think if the neurologist runs point, then he's kind of the CEO of the operation.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
I've used a neurosurgeon before to sort of run point too, because most neurosurgeons will testify, you know, we're basically the same specialty as neurologists, but we do surgery. So I think that's kind of a sort of a sexy piece of testimony, you know, from your expert at trial, like, well, this guy like actually operates on brains, just kind of a, you know, more of a for show kind of deal. I don't know how much it really differs, but if you can, or get both if the case justifies it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I guess I'm saying as opposed to starting with a psychiatrist,
right,
or starting with a therapist,
right,
or something like
that. The only reason I ever really go down that road is if the client really needs, you know, they come to me and or a family member comes to me and says they need to speak to somebody, like they're having trouble coping or dealing with stuff. Because I think, and that's one of the issues I want to touch on, is DMEs. You know, when you're doing, the defense usually is going to compel all kinds of medical examinations of your client. So, Grayson, can you give us sort of the usual IME notice, DME notices, we'll call them, when you're dealing with a brain injury claim?
Yeah, when you're dealing with a brain injury claim, I've seen everything from a psychologist to a neurologist to a neuropsychologist, audiologist, neuro-ophthalmologist. I mean, they can really go down every road here. I typically shy away from neuropsychologists unless I've got a severe traumatic brain injury and it's, you know, it's really objective there, because neuropsychologists can kind of confuse things a little bit. But when your client's going to go to a neuropsychology exam, I always make sure to tell them there's these built-in validity scales. So you need to try as hard as you possibly can on this test. You know, it's about you trying hard, because then we'll be able to seriously diagnose you and get the right diagnosis.
I think some people will disagree with our philosophy, but I think there's usually people that don't do that, that do TBIs but aren't really specialized in TBIs, they will run to a neuropsychologist. Let's get them in for a neuropsych eval. Let's do the validity testing. I think our philosophy here at the firm is, let's not use that unless we have to. I think it's such a weird testing, and it's almost built in to make it fit the way they want it to fit. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of like a biomechanic, you know, like you don't want to really affirmatively use it if you don't have to.
Exactly. And you have a much better argument too in objecting to the IME if you don't have a neuropsych.
So that was the question I wanted to bring up is, you know, the last TBI case I did, we had the neurologist exam, which is fine. That's more classified, I would assume, like a physical examination. They're not doing any sort of mental, they're doing more testing with the eyes and that sort of thing. But you have the neuropsychologist, a psychiatrist, those are mental examinations, right? And they're not entitled to those by code. They have to compel those. And so, I mean, BB, how much do you fight, you know, cumulative mental examinations? Because they're taxing. I mean, I've never had one, but yeah. Neuropsychology testing is 2 days, right?
If it's cumulative, I'll fight it every time, yeah. And I usually win those. I mean, you get to pick one if you're going to do a mental exam. And most judges, I think, agree on that.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you got to be really careful. I think people are too kind of trusting of the neuropsychology, not to dump on neuropsychologists, but I mean, they don't want you to record them. You're not allowed to see their raw score testing data. I think it's very important that you push them on that stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially the raw score.
Well, and there's nothing worse than sending your client to your own affirmative neuropsychologist and them coming back with a report that says your client's a faker.
Yeah, there's no way to really...
Which happens a lot.
You don't. I mean, that's the worst.
Or but just that the scores are normal. I mean, if you send a client to get a 3T MRI and then you send them to neuropsych and everything's coming back normal, you're proving the other side's case.
Right.
Yeah, to a certain extent, but it's hard because you don't have a neuropsych test from before the incident, right?
Right.
You know, so maybe your client was just really high functioning and then now they're normal, you know?
I think that's a great point. I think that happens a lot of times when we have, and a lot of times the MTBIs are most apparent in folks that were formerly very high functioning and very high earners, because they see the difference right away. They're in this really intense job that requires them to be firing on all cylinders every single day. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're working in a factory, maybe you don't notice it as quickly, you know? So I think that's a, and then these folks that maybe had a 130 IQ or something beforehand go take the neuropsych exam and they're average. And then the defense neuropsych's like, yeah, he's average. He's, mm-hmm. he's within normal limits on everything. I think that happens a lot.
Yeah. And I think, I think it's a misconception. I think a lot of attorneys just kind of take the other side's word for it. But when they're doing a neuropsych exam, the neuropsychs never let them record the actual testing, right? They let them record the interview part, yeah. And they say, you know, our testing is proprietary. You're not allowed to record it. We can only share it with other neuropsychologists. That's all bullshit, right?
I mean, I think within the industry, that's their code.
That's in the industry, but they're in our industry.
Well, we see it as bullshit. I mean, yeah. I'd like to see the raw scores, of course, but you know, honestly, a lot of judges see it their way, and they say, well, you're going to get them. They're just going to give them to your expert, and it remains proprietary.
And what about recording it? I've pushed on this issue before, and I've been, the judges, there is code out there that says you're allowed to record the entire examination.
I think you're right. I think per code we are correct, but a lot of times then it's going to result in a trial continuance because then they have to go get it. You're going to say, listen, the choice is you do the neuropsych exam with this guy. You can't force him to do something that he's not comfortable with. So if they have to go get a new expert, then I'm going to let them go get a new expert, and then that's going to result in a trial continuance. So you better really not like their neuropsych if you're going to do that.
Okay, so I want to kind of jump into trial and trial prep with TBI cases. BB, when you're prepping your client or you're prepping your case for trial, what's your mindset? What's kind of the process you go through? Where do you start? Do you start with the client? Do you start with the family members? Do you focus on the science? What's your philosophy?
I start with the before and after witnesses because I think they're the ones who are going to paint a picture that's so much easier for your jurors to understand. And then as long as the medicine falls in line with what they're saying, as long as your client's testimony or husband's testimony isn't wildly out of whack, I think that you can build your case around what your before and after witnesses say.
And I don't know if I've had this conversation with you or I've heard you have this conversation, but some of the better, it might not even have been a TBI case, but you wanted to talk to witnesses or people that interact with their life that aren't necessarily close to them.
Yes.
That, or maybe they get their coffee at a certain coffee shop every day.
Yeah, because they're going to have more credibility. Right. I mean, you get a family member up there and the jury automatically thinks, oh, well, they're biased. Oh, they really want to help their family member.
They want there to be something.
Right, yeah. Right.
It's nice to kind of give the jury a little taste of, you know, when you're prepping your client in anticipation for trial and they, you know, aren't as good as you would like them to be as far as testifying, maybe they get nervous, maybe they get anxious, maybe they don't remember, maybe they say the wrong, you know, they phrase their answer in the wrong way. It's nice to maybe, you know, tell the jury in opening statement, like, look, you're going to hear from my client. He's got these issues. And sometimes he does fill in the blank, right? Then you give them a little, you know, foreshadowing for, hey, you know, when my client gets impeached up there, it's because he doesn't remember shit, you know? And so then you almost excuse his, right, you know, his nervousness or his anxiety or inability to remember things.
And I think maybe not the early ones, but any TBI case that we do now at trial, we make it very clear to the jury early on that the client's not going to be there every day, right? And I think that's something you usually have to prepare the jury for beforehand. You can't just brush it under the rug and then the jury's wondering, why isn't that person there? You know, how do you address that to the jury in opening, or when do you address that, Grayson?
You know, I typically do it in jury selection, you know, and I go both ways on this. You know, I will not like my client there during jury selection. I'll just introduce them and then I'll excuse them.
Is that for all cases or is that?
For me, it's for all cases. Okay. And the way that I explain it to the jury is I say, look, you know, my client's going to be here for trial. They're going to testify. They're going to be here for closing and opening and everything like that. But when I talk to you, I just want you to be comfortable in telling me how you feel about certain things. And I find that it's easier for people to talk about certain things related to a plaintiff in a personal injury case, yeah, if they're not here. Because you might be thinking, oh, you know, I might hurt this person's feelings. But, you know, add a little humor to it. You know, I'm an attorney. I know all the lawyer jokes, so you can't offend me type of thing. So they get talking. But yeah, when you have an invisible injury like this, it's tough to have your client there every day going in and out of the courtroom, opening doors for people. They may be talking on the phone because people get used to them.
I don't have a head injury, but if I was in a jury hearing people, a trial hearing people talk about me all the time, I'd be very uncomfortable with it. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine somebody who has a head injury, you know, being okay with that.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, make them a little frazzled.
What about, back to BB's point about people who knew them before but weren't necessarily close, I love the supervisor,
yeah,
as the before witness, because it's like, this is the person's boss. They're not necessarily friends, but it's somebody who was already evaluating them kind of from an objective standpoint on a daily basis. I think that's a pretty compelling witness.
I totally agree. Yeah. And these cases, the MTBI cases, are all about credibility, because we may go down this road where we get them to a neurologist and then they go and they get an MRI, then a PET scan, and then audiologist, all this stuff. And maybe you just don't have those objective signs. So it's going to be the people that are around them really telling that story. And that's what it's all about on the MTBI cases.
So you know, one of the things that you probably are going to deal with when you have a TBI case, a lot of times our cases, there's usually a few different injuries. You know, sometimes they have an MTBI with a spinal surgery and the medical bills are pretty high, but sometimes these clients just have a head injury or a concussion. The medical bills are pretty low. So I would assume more often than not, you're probably going to try to waive past medical bills or something like that. So how are you able to, how are you guys evaluating or trying to figure out how to put a number on this person's injury? Because sometimes you're not dealing with past medical bills, because those sometimes put it into context, right? If you have a spine surgery, it's $250. Sometimes it's easier to sell that this person wants $500,000 in medical or general damages, because it's, you know, it's sort of comparable to the past medical expenses. But if somebody has zero or $10,000, how do you go about sort of selling that to a jury, Sebi?
Well, I think, you know, I think you can talk about, you know, certain assets that you have, economic assets. Just because you waive economic damages doesn't mean you can't talk about economic assets and what they're worth to you or to the jury.
Are you golden rolling me right now?
Maybe. It's called reptile. I don't know what that means. No, but you know, you can talk about these things like the price of homes in California or cars. You know, a lot of people do paintings and you know, fighter jets and things like that. And then, you know, when you analogize it to a brain, they're two completely different things. And I think, you know, the brain it's your one thing that controls your entire body and life. And, you know, I think it's very easy to, you know, justify whatever amount you put on it. You know, when talking about the very, you know, little things in life that are different and just listing them all out and then ask for a big number.
Yeah. And a per diem argument often works well because, yeah, you know, they're going on trying to live their life, but the reality is they're working. They're working really hard to appear sort of normal in everyday situations with their family, with friends, at work, if they're lucky enough to be able to have the attention to go back to work full time. They're working so much harder. And so, you know, what's your time worth in work?
Right.
And it's probably a little different for a client with an MTBI who's a high earner, like you were talking about. I mean, the economic damages, especially if they're in their 30s, 40s, and they're an engineer, they're making six figures, and then all of a sudden, you know, their voc rehab analysis is going to be off the charts probably.
For whatever reason, I happen to get these higher cases, but
you're the best
CEO for
reason,
Intel.
I only get like eight figure settlements. I don't know what it is.
So I think one thing I've started to say lately is that is in and of itself an objective finding. Somebody doesn't make, you know, $500,000 a year for 10 or 12 years in a row, and then all of a sudden just stop working to fake an injury for a maybe jury verdict. So yeah. I don't need an MRI or a PET scan or anything. That is, I think that's objective.
So, I mean, those cases are probably going to be a little easier to get a high settlement or a high verdict, but it's those clients that maybe aren't high earners, or, you know, they're Hispanic immigrants and they don't really have, they're not skilled workers. You know, how do you sell that person's damages, their general damages, are equivalent to a doctor or an engineer? How do you deal with those kind of hurdles?
I don't know. I think you just talk about it in jury selection, and then you really want to hammer on it being a personality change and get, you know, the people that are close to them to say, hey, this is a different person. You know, it's a different person before and after the incident. And you can kind of talk about that stuff in jury selection. You know, hey, if this was a doctor versus this is a janitor, you know, are their damages going to be different? Does this person suffer differently than this person? And really get people to start thinking about that in jury selection. But really, you know, it's just hammering on that this is a different person and this completely changed them and they're never going to be the same. And it affects everybody around them, you know?
One thing I want to say that maybe it's unrelated is also just as important as meeting with your client early on and seeing if they, and identifying whether they do have a mild traumatic brain injury, I think it's really important to identify if they don't. And we take a lot of cases over that are kind of handed off to us. And like Brandon said, there's a lot of times where someone has orthopedic injuries from a big crash, and then they also have, you know, they had some headaches initially, or they had an MTBI, they had a concussion initially, but it got better. If it got better, then just say it got better. I just, concussion, yeah.
Too many times
I feel like folks are trying to chase down a lead on an MTBI that just isn't there. And you lose credibility on the rest of your case when you're focused too much on that. I don't know what you guys think about that.
But no, it's a good point.
Totally agree.
It also adds credibility to your other injuries, because you're like, look, if this guy's just out here for a buck, trying to make a buck, we could have just, you know, said, oh, he's got this and continue to do that and sell this. But you're saying, no, this one resolved, as did his, you know, neck sprain he had, but he's got the low back surgery.
Right. He had a concussion, which by definition is a mild traumatic brain injury. He had headaches for 6 months and he had some vertigo, and that it was treated and it got better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But his spine didn't.
Yeah. So while we're on the topic, is there any other sort of common missteps that you can make when you're working up an MTBI case that you can think of? Kind of pitfalls to avoid?
Not treating the psychological part of it, the depression and anxiety part of it, when there's multiple components of an injury, if there's like cognitive dysfunction, diminished, like this case that we're working on right now is a diminished executive function. And it's kind of a hornet's nest. And I think a lot of the better experts like to try to sort out the problem so we can isolate the main issue. If the main issue is cognitive dysfunction, then let's focus on that and try to treat everything else that can be resolved.
Oh, Teresa, just our producer just passed me some viewer questions. So let's see what we got here. Presenting damages witness at trial. I think we kind of covered that a little bit, talking with supervisors or people that maybe aren't that close to them that have sort of the day-to-day interactions or...
I'll touch on the damages witnesses. Yeah, I think when they're actually taking the stand, it's important to not have them just get up there and say, oh, these are the differences I noticed, but actually load them up with stories, with anecdotes. Let them paint a picture of a 30-second interaction, because that's so much more meaningful and hits a gut level, an emotional understanding.
It's a really good point. We had a trial where the wife was talking about the husband. He was forgetful and he would never leave the stove on before the incident, and now he always leaves the stove on. She talked about one time him leaving the stove on and almost starting the entire house on fire. And just that little story, I mean, it was huge for people. They a lot of jurors talked about it afterwards. They were like, wow, like I can't imagine like having to worry about that, leave my kids home with my husband, and like I got to worry about him burning them down, you know. So that's a really good point.
Yeah, so finding little stories, anecdotes.
That's just a great point in general in all litigation, especially like defense lawyer is taking your deposition of your client and they're evaluating the case for settlement. Every defense lawyer has heard pain, I have trouble sleeping, I can't lift as much weight as I could before. All those things, they just start to sound generic, I think, to a guy who's taken a million depositions. But when you give a real story that hits home, it changes everything. I have a good one that I always use in depo prep. I won't bore you guys with it, plus it'll make me cry. So
do it.
It's a good one. All right, you want to hear it?
What a cliffhanger.
You want to hear it?
I won't bore you with it, but it'll make you cry.
So I was on the defense side. I was taking the deposition. I deposed the husband who had, like, it wasn't even that big of a case. It was a shoulder injury with a couple of cervical injections. And I had the case valued going into it. And he testified. And he said, he was truthful. He said all the same things that the wife ultimately did in the afternoon. But he just, it was much more generic. Nothing he said really changed my evaluation of the case in one way or the other. He said, you know, I have a harder time playing with my kids now. I don't wrestle around with them as much. The wife testifies in the afternoon and says, we have two kids. One's autistic, one's not. The autistic kid, he doesn't communicate. If you understand anything about autism, he doesn't really understand, like, when you talk to him, you can't just say, I love you so much, even though I don't play with you anymore. He doesn't understand that, right? But his dad would spend so much time with him and play with him and wrestle with him. He can't do that anymore. And he said, he said to the mom, how come daddy doesn't love me anymore? Mm. And I was like, that case just tripled in value.
And you were like, it's an open policy. Yeah, I was like, if she demanded the policy anymore.
Well, I wrote on my report, I said, if she takes the stand and says that, you're going to get six or seven jurors are going to cry and give her whatever she asks for.
Thanks, yeah. Ryan. Yeah, you weren't kidding.
Be careful what you wish for, yeah. Sammy.
Yeah, so, I mean, any other kind of tips or... Well, let me ask this. You sign up a case straight off the streets. You know, our cases usually get brought to us when they're pretty deep into litigation, so we don't really have a... Can't really get to send the client where we want them to. Say you do sign up a case off the street and the client just had a concussion last week. Is the first person you're getting them into a neurologist? Is that kind of, at least for that complaint, or are you waiting to do that to see if it's something that is still sticking around after a few months? Or
I wait a little bit to see if it's getting better because I don't want to jump the gun and start spending a ton of money. And
your attorney sent you to so-and-so. Right. Yeah.
And, you know, they just had their life upended. Yeah. You know, so if we start sending them on things that are not necessary, then you're going to lose some trust with the client too.
Yeah. Okay. Any other parting words with MTBI cases? Any advice in general for people that are wanting to take these cases on or going to trial on some of these cases? You know, some forewarning maybe to some of you guys that have been in TBI trials?
Have a lot of patience.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of follow-up. There's a lot of hand-holding. There are a lot of emotions that run around, and I think when you take a case on like that, you're jumping into a huge family life-altering situation, and so you have to have a lot of patience with people.
Yeah, I think that more, like I said before, more than any other type of injury, that is the client that you're going to have to have a little bit more time with, a little bit more face time, a little bit more hand-holding, just because the nature of the injury.
Yeah, so much frustration and just misunderstanding of what's going on with me, especially if there's no imaging studies to say that's what's wrong with you right there.
Yeah.
Now, BB, do you subscribe to the give your client your cell phone number club?
I do.
You do?
I do.
Oh,
dangerous. That's dangerous.
I do it.
Yeah, I do it too. As much as I say I don't. I mean,
I wouldn't recommend it to anyone else, but I do.
Well, I'll say this. I've changed my tune on that a little bit. I was very against that for a while, but you have to know the client before you do that, right? Very early on, I was just like, hey, call me, whatever. But I think you have to know which client you're giving that to first. I'm not totally against it, but don't just do it.
I do it, and then I threaten to revoke privileges very rarely.
Sometimes you send the fake automatic reply. Verizon Wireless does not accept text messages anymore. Sevi, any parting words to people that are taking on TBI cases? Or
no, I think we've covered it.
Yeah, great. Thanks for the insight. Marat, you got anything back there?
I don't talk just to talk.
Yeah, sure you don't.
I thought this was so good. One of the best episodes ever. That's all I got.
Is that a Trumpism? Is that your...
This episode was the greatest, most amazing TBI episode in the history of episodes.
All right. I think
what's something... So isn't there sometimes an issue with like inner ear, like cochlear issues?
Yeah.
And how do you find that out?
Vestibular balance. That's something that is a little bit more nuanced that... I've had conversations with other attorneys that swear by them, and they think that they blow it out of the water, and that you can't disprove it. I just don't have a lot of experience in it. Ryan,
I've never done.
Yeah,
it.
I've never really.
I've done some of those, and that's one thing throughout the day when we've been talking about it. When we say MTBI, I mean there's so many different types of cases because there's so many different types of symptoms. It's anything from somebody who just has recurring headaches to somebody who has lost the ability to focus and function and
tinnitus
memory,
or whatever.
To ringing in the ears, to these vestibular, you know, you're dizzy, nauseous. I think it's all over the place. But there are some, if you have that vestibular issue, I think it's important to try to find a neurologist who specializes in that. And if your issue is headaches, find somebody who specializes in migraines.
Yeah, don't send somebody to a vestibular, you know, balance expert or wherever they are, if they don't have that issue.
Right. Somebody who's
disproving your case.
Right. Somebody whose primary problem is memory. They don't need to go to a vestibular imbalance guy and vice versa. But I do think those cases are, they can be good because it's more of a physical thing. I think it's easier for a jury to understand, you can imagine dizziness because everybody's had it. Everybody's been nauseous. Everybody's felt a little bit of, you know, disorientation. Not everybody's ever experienced memory loss. That's a weird thing to try to imagine.
A word finding.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that wraps it up. I mean, we could probably spend a whole hour on different types of advanced imaging techniques and all that stuff and raw score data testing and all that, but I think we hit the tip of the iceberg and kind of gave a good little brief introduction to MTBIs and kind of what to look for and how to handle trials and litigation with MTBIs. So thank you for listening. Thank you to the panel. Thank you for BB for coming up from San Diego. And no sleep till
justice.
All right. You got a limp, you got back pain from the nerve impingement.
Just wait till we go down on the good
of you. They got the closing into your cream. I'll fight again. Depose the witness from the scene. Your medals
are on a stuff you said that was specific came fight out of the deposition, so you no are
so fine.
Right.
For you, when a car crashed into you, and I'll make them. Jury trial. Cross-stitch first with some. They roll jurors as their credit's blown. Lies exposed were crazy about you. Oh, when that truck crashed into you. Yeah, painted. The verdict a little more, expose the insured to me. Oh, I got the verdict a little more, expose the insured to me in a jury trial. In a jury trial, crash into you.